Yeah.
Dominic Smith from one that was doing a PhD at Crump. James Wallbank, our glorious CEO of Access Space.
CEO, yes.
CEO.
Laughably
somebody who is doing a PhD at Sheffield University School of Architecture and is currently doing an R&D version of this. Where are we? Who else is Patrice, who will be seeing in the first half. And Nick Haskell. And is that everybody? And Tony. Yeah. There's Tony Crew from the first half. So,
can I write down a question?
Yes.
They're
all working.
Black, that's not working.
Oh, is that right?
Black, that's not working.
Oh, right.
So, how should we do this? Would somebody from the panel like to pick a question from the board and start to address it?
Well, we could, for instance, because I was looking at the questions, maybe the one which is a very concise and simple one, just four letters. Intellectual property is theft? Question mark. Maybe the person who wrote that could explain a little further what.
We talked a bit about how. It was good that, you know, so many of us were hacking and so many kids are hacking. And that just got me thinking, and how it was good that we could all go on a torrent site and download as much music as we wanted, and it wouldn't cost us £31,000. And I was just thinking that intellectual property is one of these new, sort of newish concepts. And I wonder if some of the revolutionary stuff about it's good to hack this intellectual property. If you proposed that it was great that we could all walk into each other's houses and like walk out with our favourite t-shirts and our shoes, then we'd probably object to that. But you know, it's good to be able to take songs from artists. And you know, I just wonder I'm really struggling myself with what intellectual property is about, and is it a good idea or a bad idea? Some of my intellectual property, my bank account number, I want to keep absolute tight ownership of. But I'd like other sorts of intellectual property, scientific papers and things like that. I'm annoyed that I can't read them or listen to music or that kind of thing. So, and I just wonder whether some of this revolutionary stuff about saying property is theft, it should all be free, doesn't work very well when it comes to t-shirts and things, but perhaps it works a lot better when it comes to at least some sorts of information.
But maybe I can say something about that. And that is that when I was writing my thesis, it's almost 30 years ago, I came across an interesting concept which I thought, let's take that instead of intellectual property, which at that time was not so much talking about. It existed somehow, but it was not as big as it is now. Now it's so big that you can call it IP. An IP is intellectual property, but it's not in strictly internet terms, when it's something else. And that was proprietary knowledge. And proprietary knowledge exactly pointed to the contradictory thing, that you could own knowledge, which is somehow, it's of course, doesn't make sense. Now, your bank account number, for instance, is not intellectual property. It's a thing. Just by means, basically, it's like you would say that a banknote in your wallet is intellectual property, in the sense that it's artwork or it has been designed or something like that. What has happened is that intellectual property is actually a fraudulent word, which has been devised by corporate interests to make believe that something is a property when it cannot be a property. If you say, for instance, that ideas cannot be owned, that knowledge cannot be owned, then you understand that something like intellectual property doesn't make very much sense, actually. And when you say that, the last thing is that when you say that, it's so fun, let's steal some music from artists. But in practice, what happens when you steal music from artists is that you rip off corporate interest of, say, you steal £10 worth of music from artists. Then you rip off corporates for something like £9.90, and the artist for 10p. These 10p, and actually far more than 10p, there are ways for the artist to collect from you, which you are absolutely prepared to pay for. I mean, I think many, many, many people would be glad to pay the actual creators rather than to pay the mediators. And that's where the whole thing is the whole matter about intellectual property is going about. But so to resume, I think intellectual property is we should not let ourselves use the word intellectual property in the way corporate wants us to understand.
I suppose by using my bank number, I meant to say that that's a piece of information which I want to control the use of. So it's that control, that which I mean by ownership, is controlling the way that information is used.
But there's this slogan, maybe the slogan of the Chaos Computer Club devised in the early 80s is helpful. It was saying, make all public data freely available and protect strongly private data. Private information, like your bank card, things that are directly linked to yourself and your well-being yourself, of course. Nobody's thinking about stealing that.
The best way to use it is Marxism, rent. Think of rent. You can't rent your bank account, but you can't rent what they call corporate intellectual property. It's renting of it, not yourself.
Could I sort of suggest that I think that a lot of the questions around intellectual property, sorry, I'm going to talk away from you now,
yeah,
so I hope that's all right. But a lot of it is to do with the mechanisms of a so-called creative economy. You know, that essentially what you've got is a situation in which, in the so-called creative economy, the mediators, non-creative mediators, if you like, middlemen,
yeah,
are hugely economically dominant, right? And one's got to ask myself, well, why is that? that's the way that it's turned out in our current manifestation of the creative economy. But it seems to me that the key to this is that CBS or Sony Records or whoever would be much more positive about information sharing if creativity was subject to mechanization. But almost the definition of creativity is it's that thing which is not subject to automation, industrialization, mechanization. Okay, so it's the very resistance of creativity, whatever that thing is, you know. I mean, is creativity the capacity to surprise us or delight us? I don't know. But whatever it is, it's resistant to mechanization, and that's the reason why mediators, if you like, the parts of that distribution system that are subject to mechanization have been the bits that have become highly monetized. Now, I mean, my sort of suggestion for the future is that as intellectual property becomes disrespected, you know, ideas of intellectual property, particularly thinking about media content, as that intellectual property becomes respected less and less, which it will do, perhaps not by teenagers in the Western world, perhaps by the Chinese government, perhaps by developing world nations, you know, I mean, they don't care, you know, and some of them have nuclear weapons. But as this happens, the centre of gravity of earning power of the creative economy, I suggest, will move from the intellectual property zone to a new zone, which is the zone of capacity to create. And that is potentially very, very positive. In other words, if you get involved in the creative economy, what you'll actually get paid for is what you're going to create next, not what you've already created. And that potentially is a tremendously positive thing for individual creative people.
Is that any sense?
Well,
Yeah.
It's interesting that I've got someone agreeing with me on that.
Lawrence Lessig in the Creative Commons development, I mean, he actually, in Free Culture, very strangely, to deal with this issue of remuneration for musicians or whatever, introduced the idea of a tax, which seemed very, very surprising, because it was this idea that you have to remunerate the creator, which is clearly not what, I agree with Patrice, not what IP is all about. And there's been another conception of the idea of copyleft, which is the thing that Creative Commons is perhaps based on, which a chap called Dimitri Kleiner has developed further into copy far left, which I think seems to be a very interesting proposition, that the emphasis is put, unlike on Creative Commons, which puts emphasis on the producer of the work and protects the producer, copy far left tries to give more emphasis on the user, on the consumer of the consumer in a financial sense. But so copy far left proposes a license whereby it's about production, it's about material production, but saying that that's okay if you are an individual, or you don't exploit wage labour and so on, so you're not a capitalist organisation or a private company. And I think that's something I've just recently sort of discovered, but I think it shifts the discussion somewhat. I'd be interested to know what Patrice and Tony, the others, think of that.
Are you talking about a compulsory tax?
That's what Lawrence Lessig was talking about, but actually there's no tax in... Yeah.
Yeah.
Within this copy far left, there's no tax at all. It's just it's a different version of a license.
I spoke to Dimitri about it a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah, Kleiner. And he's I think the problem he has, and I'll try to subvert his time once if I ever become a staff member of a PhD. I think he needs just years to develop it. It's a great idea, but he needs time to work.
Yeah.
You know, he works and he has kids and family, so it's very limited, and he manages to write those pieces in Mute, which are really great, and I recommend people read it. But it's basically cooperative. And my critique of that, yes, fine, but you can have a deeply right-wing cooperative. The fact that people can decide for themselves, for me, as someone who's trying to redevelop communist ideas, really means nothing at all. People voted for Nazis in Germany. People vote here for all kind of, you know, semi-Nazis we have. So... It's great, yes.
Yeah.
It's a good idea to say let's limit what capital can do with our labor within the copyleft, and that's copyleft far left, you know. But it doesn't resolve the problem of an overall, you know, totality. So in a sense, it's again like slightly for me libertarian individualist thinking.
Where we didn't go with the discussion yesterday, from trying to find definitions that obviously don't want to go into here.
Yeah.
Just the fact that the open source, like the South African apartheid regime, used a lot of open source software. It can be used by many people.
A good example of that is I saw a presentation recently by the core developer of one of the firewall systems. I've forgotten which one it is. It's not IPCOM. Smoothwall,
yeah.
And he was the Smoothwall firewalling distribution is open source software,
yeah.
And he was contacted by activists in Myanmar, which is a highly oppressive regime, who said, you know, we're disgusted by you. In fact, he had death threats, saying, why are you working for this fascist regime? And he wrote back, sort of somewhat upset, saying, you know, I'm not working for them. This is open source software, so this is software which could be used by anybody. And it happens to be being used to censor your access, limit your access to the internet, to information, and to monitor your internet usage. I'm really sorry. And he had a big moral dilemma there of how could he, on the one hand, try to make his code and his processes open, but also to ensure that he wasn't part of an oppressive activity. And his his solution, actually, which I think perhaps wasn't ideal, but is very interesting, is that he actually entered into an education process with these activists, telling them the exploits that he was aware of, but which he hadn't publicised or pointed out, which would allow you to subvert the system he created in order to access the data which it attempts to stop you from doing. So, yeah, he felt that that kind of education process was a way that he could kind of even up the moral score.
You think things like that will always happen, because when things are out there, they're out there.
No one should be surprised by that.
Yeah.
A pretty lightweight, trivial example I can think of is I once saw Cyndi Lauper, another orange-haired American, singing Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. And it was like one of the worst things I've ever, and this was being recorded for television. And it was just like shockingly bad. But what control had the copyright owners of that song to stop this awful woman singing this song? Because it's out there.
Yeah.
And then, well, that's quite funny. But then I thought about it afterwards. Well, it did encourage me to go back out and dig the original out, and maybe if it encourages other people to go and find out who actually wrote this song. Mm. So, whether it's software, hardware, music, whatever, once these things are out there, they're out there, aren't they? And, more so nowadays with the internet and the rapid communications.
But it's
to close up,
yeah.
The thing I like what you were saying, though, is that this guy actively did something to put right. And if Cyndi Lauper ever wants to sing one of my songs, I hope I'd put it right.
I think for me, a lot of, and it's no, I think, coincidence, a lot of hacking has been always linked with anarchism because of the self-organization element. And for me, what matters is combination of practice and theory. If you remove, you know, when we talk about software, how it's used, for me, it's almost irrelevant. It is more the political aspect of it. If you derive it out of it and then create a new practice, you know, you get to a new political project. I mean, open source did that. I mean, the main argument of open source was, we're just pragmatists, we're only methodologically based in terms of Linux. Linux releasing the kernel often, frequently, all the time, small patches, therefore feeling people really good being part of it, because if you give someone a contribution and it's on the publicly released within 2 days with your name, it feels good, so you'll do it again. There was a novelty of open source, for sure, which even actually I think Eric Raymond did not describe very well at all in his books and papers. But what he did as well was remove ethics, remove open process. He, for example, never mentions open process, nor does Free Software Foundation anywhere, because people don't think in those terms. You know, anarchist theory itself is never systematic. It never looks at the system as a whole. It looks at the small pockets. And so it's very well suited for this libertarian way of thinking, which I agree with Patrice, is a lot less among anarchists than it's usually, I think, in a way, maybe even conveniently, spread, that, you know, it's fair libertarian. But to answer this, of course, it's politics and ethics, and the politics as a new form of organization. I mean, it is for me, when you talk about free software, it's the ideas of free software. Why did Richard Stallman refuse it? You know, what he did when he refused to work within the intellectual property, well, actually, it was patent at that time, model. And why is it the most convincing? For him, it was, of course, ethical decision. He said, I will choose how to form communities with other people, I choose to have the right to help other people, and I choose to have the right to share. That's very powerful. When you say it like that and you don't discuss it, you know, it's, no one can tell you, oh, it's about political beliefs or is it morals. You know, for you, this is a ground. You claim your ground and you don't move. I mean, that's why I think it's useful to read it in religious...
almost religious.
Yes, it is. You know, Paul, Damascus, in conversion, it is a religious moment. Well, it makes sense when you read it. But you actually
don't forget also that, especially in the American context, the exact reverse of that, which we think is either, kind of a bit strange, or yes, maybe it's the actual world, but we don't give very much weight to it. So the exact opposite of the right to share.
Yeah.
There is a political doctrine which forbids you to share.
Yeah, of course.
And, well, it's not. It's, I don't think it's obvious.
No, it's not obvious.
I'm thinking under the. You cannot exaggerate, for instance, the influence in American political thinking of Ayn Rand. Do I pronounce it?
Yes,
correct. Ayn Rand, who almost dogmatized that altruism is wrong.
Yeah.
It's morally wrong. It's
I only know that work because I read an obituary of her recently. I think
yeah.
She died, but
yeah.
Many people don't know.
What was the name of the person?
From time to time, it surfaces, if not. Actual legislation in legislation proposals to really restrict the right to share, obviously, but basically to restrict the right to cooperate, the right
yeah.
to.
There's an example that I know because it affects me personally, which is a completely crazy one. Where it's now, if you actually look at the detail of things, it's actually illegal to make an agreement. Say if you're a parent of a child, it's illegal to make a regular agreement with another parent of another child to share childcare.
No way.
And there were two women who were both police officers, and they were actually prosecuted for it because they had an agreement. They both had children,
yeah.
And they had an agreement to look after each other's children when they were on shifts, and they did get prosecuted for it. And I've known
these
about
were
this for some
women.
Years. These were policemen. That
but
is
their
is
their kids, yeah. So, the
state yeah.
Kids.
So all these informal
well,
things
state
that
kids.
I'm sure we've all experienced as children and possibly as parents as well, where you say Tuesdays this person collects the two children and Wednesdays this person collects the child, is actually now
illegal.
So that brings me to aside from being an extraordinary fact, I think that would sort of bring me to a question really, which is how do you get this there are a lot of people around who've got a very strong political and ethical sensibility that would probably find themselves in tune with the sorts of things being said in this room. Yeah? So how might you start to have a stronger dialogue with a much, much broader constituency about the things that we value within the free software of the sort of social practice and so on. So how do you start to have that dialogue and find the contact points with a much, much broader constituency? I think that's always my...
That's something I'd like to touch on a little bit. My background isn't in coding or in computers, really. It is in computers, but not in free software. I'm an architect, but I'm now doing a PhD and teaching a bit, but I'm no longer operating as an architect, building buildings like the one over the road for millions of pounds. I'm trying to do more of a critique of the profession and the discipline of architecture and planning from a point of view which believes that the current sort of systems of architecture and planning are very hegemonic, based on capitalist values, and are actually very oppressive, and that they actually are one form of control and so on. That a lot of this thinking is sort of challenging. So I'm now doing a bit of R&D at Access Space, which is looking at the idea, bringing the ideas of free software, open source, whatever that discussion is about. Into the realm of architecture and design and vice versa, and seeing what happens when they go together. But one of the real concerns for me, one of the interesting things for me about this, is that it gives a kind of, the question I put on there was where does hacking take place, and the reason for that was just to say that it gives it a kind of a tangible location. It actually has a site, and I've asked Jake and a few others, you know, where does open source take place, what's its site? Because for architecture, there is a need to for it to be happening in a place, and I think that relation between the material and the immaterial becomes very interesting in that. But in terms of what Lisa mentioned there, my real interest is how we can actually, because one of the problems with the architectural system dominance and hegemonic system, is that people, everyday people, are very, very much disconnected from it. So there's a feeling that we can't affect our environment. We can't. We either don't have enough money, or we don't understand the codes and regulations and so on associated to with architecture and planning and so on. So we feel kind of disempowered in that sense. And yet it is very effective to everybody on a daily basis. And so I'm trying to do some research that really looks at how we can actually engender a kind of an interest in architecture as an everyday political site of action and of involvement. And I think this is where the ideas of open source and for free ideas come in, to sort of reveal things, to sort of reveal hegemonic or oppressive forces through these channels to people that wouldn't normally be interested in or acknowledge them, and then to sort of engender in a way a kind of a value on that, and then potentially some action. So how can we actually take, it's a bit like hacking the land, I guess, or it's a version of hacking the state potentially, because you can actually look for what a group called CityMind have called cracks, based in Barcelona, and they look for cracks in the city, cracks in the urban fabric, where you can actually kind of intervene and appropriate a space and build something or make something come together. So I think, yeah, that's one way, that one field in which we can try and engender participation.
To answer to this, to me, the answer is definitely New Economic Foundation. There was 21-hour paper they published last month, February. And they make a very quantitative, within capitalist language and neoliberal language, argument why the society needs to go to 21-hour a week work. And for me, that's key work. I put it in my kind of PhD proposal in 2 years ago. It was key. When I looked exactly what you said, I realized, unless you go to 3 days a week, because I struggled for years, but I was privileged, you know, to be too important for that company at that time. 3 years later, even the other kids were better than me, but you know, you find yourself in a moment they need you. And I was a tough negotiator, where I said, just, I enrolled Goldsmith's sociology, I'm not available 5 days a week, it's 3 days a week, take it or leave. I didn't ask them permission. That's, you know, capitalists know very well, they never ask permission for anything. Look at Google. They scan all the books and then let's have writers and, you know, negotiate with us. So I think that's another strategy that the left doesn't know how to use, is take the right and then let them complain. But I think that can only be done, answer actually to that, and to that when we go to 3 days a week. And I think left has to, you know, by all means necessary, you know, anything, including lawyers, aggression, protests, bribe if it takes, whatever, you know. I mean, clean, who plays clean fence anymore? For 3 days a week. And then on 3 days a week, as a state recognized pattern, that's normal. Then you can have spent a couple of days a week, still have a family, and actually have your moms fighting, have a lawyer with you, have free software hackers, create groups online, and basically through civic activism, but in a formalized way, which is part of your work, is just not the paycheck that pays your bills. I think that's a model that's possible.
There's quite a lot of things I want to say. In terms of architecture, architectural kind of theorists, academics, are quite deluded, in my view, in as much as they think that they think that architects actually kind of, to a large extent, determine the form of the built environment produced by a society. But that's actually just not true. Architects, you know, follow fashion and make buildings look different to some extent, but they don't really fundamentally determine the kind of form of the built environment. Fundamentally, the form of the built environment's a product of the society that produced it. And if you want a better built environment, you actually need to fundamentally change the nature of society that's producing the built environment in the first place. And I mean, I don't think there's much hope of things kind of changing from the top down architecturally. I think the most interesting stuff done on architecture, I've not been following it for the last decade or so, but the kind of work of Christopher Alexander with the pattern language, and he looked at how to create a democratic process of design and production, a process of production in which the people that are going to use the building plus the people that are making the building have the freedom to be creative and have an input into it. And he did a small-scale housing project in Mexico in probably the 80s, and his book about that's called The Production of Houses. So I mean the answer with architecture is we actually need a democratic production process in which all the people involved with the production of a building have the freedom to contribute to it creatively. And I mean that's what I think about architecture, but that's kind of going off topic maybe slightly. But however, I think the potentially the biggest contribution to the free software movement might hopefully, you know, make is I think the method of production of free software is potentially applicable to the production of pretty much anything. And what we actually need is basically a change, fundamental change in the mode of production of everything. And I think the free software mode of production, there's a lot of lessons there that can be applied to the production of other stuff. And I think we need to get on with that very, very urgently due to the multiple crises we're facing in terms of climate, resource depletion, peak oil. I mean, overall, the kind of impact of human society at the moment is such that we're kind of on the verge of passing tipping points where we begin to render the biosphere as uninhabitable for mammals in terms of mass extinction, you know, so on and so forth. The question this started with is intellectual property theft. Intellectual property is basically, at the moment, it's used to create artificial scarcity in order to make vast profits for corporations. And I think it's at a time when there is real scarcity, there's a billion people starving, spending a lot of money to create artificial scarcity is just, it's just insanity, really.
What I'm going to say is the archives that I kind of represent, the Polytechnic, I've spent the last year trying to take these methods away from the computing environment and to kind of stress test and see what works in an alternate environment and what doesn't work. This is kind of why I wrote this, you can't cut the loaf of bread without a pound of flour. And what I was meaning by writing that was that you can, it's the free software strategy or environment exists in one of the ways because copying data is very cost effective. It's very easy to do, to create a concurrent version system where people can upload bits of code and people can be working in a distributed fashion at different time zones in different parts of the world. But to take that system, because we're in quite a privileged environment here, really, to have shares, to feel well fed, so we can kind of talk about this. But to take that system and put it in an environment where people are kind of starving and don't have those resources, to say, well, here's a sauce recipe for a loaf of bread. You can't copy that recipe, you can't work with that recipe unless you have the flour to make the bread.
Right. So what sort of things did you do?
Green mushrooms, DNA hacking, anything kind of wet and kind of earthy, kind of trying not to be switching a monogram while we're working, but to be working with the open source methods and the methods of distribution. One of the things we've done as part of the research has been interviewing artists who could release the work into the commons, and the question I asked every single one of them was, have you ever been a small part of somebody else's bigger project? And of course most of these artists kind of drew an instant blank because they were the charismatic leaders of their projects. Mm. So what we did with the mushroom project was that wasn't our idea, that was somebody else's idea. It was somebody who works with commons, and I kind of managed to kind of have your idea, please. And you kind of knock yourself out, thinking like, you know, that'll never work, sort of thing. So what we did then was an experiment, seeing how it was partly an experiment, just how he would react with somebody modifying his work.
So tell me what you did and where you did it.
Oh,
okay,
your
details. Is that good?
Very briefly. It was a project called The Shredder, and it was a smaller part of a big project done by Julian Priest. Free software, cross manuals, Adam Hyde. And what they did was they took software manuals, redundant software manuals were kind of outdated. Software had moved on several iterations since the manuals written. They shredded them mixed them with coffee grounds, with those two things being the staple of the geek's day. And what they did was they composted them down and grew sugar beet with them. This is New Zealand, and actually Richard Stallman went to visit them, and they've got a photograph of Stallman planting some seeds in this kind of... But apparently Dewey makes a lot of hardware, and Stallman's been bugging in ever since to make the BIOS open. Actually, it was getting like kind of stalked by Richard Stallman at the moment. But what we did was took that idea and applied it to a project in the Northeast where we were on a short time scale, so there's a growing region for mushrooms. In that way, the mushrooms were then grown and cut and cooked in the cafe that the grounds came from. So they're taking something that was like a completely redundant medium and resource. So I was looking at food and resources as well, you know, trying to establish a project that wasn't so energy hungry, really.
One thing that I think we should do. Resonates, excuse the word, which both of you were saying, is that it's not for now, but keep it in mind, it's to really problematize scarcity. Scarcity is just like, it's a fraud like intellectual property, I would think.
And just to think that one of two important things out of that sentence, that we took his idea and we went with it, so that people can have ideas attributed to them,
mm-hmm.
and that then they can be used by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's been talk about trying to you know, dismantle the flawed capitalist economy and replace it with something else. What else? Well, I've often thought that the fundamental motivation for a lot of human behaviour, why I get up in the morning or why one of us gets up in the morning and does stuff, is one of the primary motivators is to get on in the world, to sort of gain status and to gain sort of acclaim of your fellow humankind, as well as obviously to bring the food in and to keep warm and dry. So, and I think this knowledge sort of economy with this idea of the Creative Commons, I think, gives the ability to, you know, give people reputation directly, not money as a sort of symbolic sort of sign of how much we appreciate you, but just give you appreciation sort of thing. And because there's no problem with the world going nuts, sort of accumulating more and more and more reputation. We're not going to like boil the oceans dry, relentlessly pursuing reputation. Whereas if we relentlessly pursue small green pieces of paper, small brown pieces of paper, whatever, that then tie into oil and stuff like that, then we will bleed the planet dry, sort of thing. So perhaps this idea of having information that is identified to us so we can own it in the sense that we unambiguously attribute it to us, but then share it. And the two things together, the sort of ownership of the information and the attributation of it and the giving it away, put them together and they give us a reputation kind of economy where if I say lots of clever, insightful things that other people find valuable, like again and again and again on forums and in reality, then I'll be sort of deemed as worthy. And then if I get really desperate for a meal, then I can hit one of you for a meal because I've been such a good, valuable company kind of thing. And we've got to scale this up. If we're all doing information work, you know, and the planet's food has been grown by 0.1% of the population sitting on robot control vehicles, you know, then everyone else is doing information work. I mean, is this where we're going? Is this the end of the capitalist cash scarcity economy that we got to a reputation economy? And it's only scarce because it's a relative economy.
No, I don't think so. It's just a new... It changes the form. But to come back to what you said, it's... it was 10 p.m. when Žižek said BBC Two, his culture show. You're going to see the interview with Slavoj Žižek like 2 months ago. He finished the interview completely rendering the whole show meaningless when he said, "See you in hell or in communism." And then there was a 5 minute silence. And then the cameraman and then the guys holding the mics bursted laughing, at which point the guy who was interviewing bursted laughing as well because they couldn't believe. But for me, this is, again, because of trauma of the left on, you know, with the Soviet project and or whatever, you know, East Europe, in the heads of people here meant, because, of course, I grew up in socialism in Yugoslavia, so it meant something completely different to me. People tend to forget, people either discard it or the old people on the left read it in a very dogmatic way, and there's no middle ground. But if you say, I mean, the sharing, when someone says sharing, that's a communist idea, it's in Communist Manifesto, it's 8-hour work, it's education, it's free health for all, It's mandatory sharing of all wealth. That's in Communist Manifesto. So why are we fooling ourselves? People just fear political words and fear political projects. Maybe communism is not the word or the term that we need to describe some new project. But it's definitely that's in Communist Manifesto that needs to be wrested from the old dogmatic left, which unfortunately still holds monopoly. That's, for me, deeply embedded in software. You know, many, many times when I read it, it's all over the place.
Something else which occurs to me, and this is not written on the board, I'm really sorry, so I'm going off topic here, but one of the things that I think Marx says in the Communist Manifesto is that, you know, in a kind of ideal situation, that people would be able to occupy themselves with various different activities throughout the day.
Yes, yes.
That in some cases they would be working the land, or, you know, digging their garden. At other times they would be writing or doing intellectual work and so on and so forth. And that somehow, instinctively, this would be a nice thing. This would be a kind of a pleasant lifestyle. And one of the things that it occurs to me about the way that technology manifests itself is that it asks us to move further and further away from that sort of variety of tasks and to further and further become a super specialized, you know, a super specialized worker, to the point where you can have a super specialized worker who is a PostgreSQL database developer, but not a MySQL database developer. I mean, the levels of specialization can get so boggling that even the expert can't, you know, can barely distinguish these skill sets. And it just seems to me that one of the things that is happening with the manifestation of proprietary technologies is that they're requiring us to become more and more specialized. Whereas, so if you like, if you see technology as a system in which human beings have to conform to it, whereas what the general public license as an open license does is it provides a kind of a handbook or a mechanism saying, here is this software. You could use it in a variety of ways to fit it into your life. On the one hand, you might want to use it because you're a software user, but then again, you might want to base a business on it, you might want to develop it, you might want to share it, alter it, you might wish to make it into a poem. There's all sorts of ways that you might want to reuse this. So this is, if you like, a handle for you, the user, right? And what that suggests is a nesting the other way around, that you have a human process and that technology should conform to the human process. So that you're kind of nesting technology within a human network, not humans within a technological network. I don't know whether that helps, sorry, but it just suddenly occurred to me.
On this thing about you can't copy a loaf of bread but without a pound of flour, we kind of think that, you know, copying an album of MP3s is, you know, costs us very little, and it does appear to cost us very little. But I think we all too easily forget the ecological footprint that the production of the hardware that we're using, the amount of fossil fuels used for electricity, all the transportation, the fact that all these rare materials have been combined into these computers that are designed to last for 2 or 3 years, and then get, you know, incinerated and landfilled, or just landfilled, and it's an incredible waste of resources that will not be possible in the future as the kind of the amount of available energy declines. So, you know, it copying stuff does appear to be very cheap, almost free for people, but, you know, don't forget that that's only because of, you know, where we are in time. One interesting project that's looking at applying open source kind of ideas to things like agriculture and stuff is the, I don't know if you've come across the kind of open farm tech people, but there's this group in the States that are looking at creating the world's first open source ecological eco-village. I think it's Google Open Farm Tech and you'll come across it. And they've got an open source tractor, the Life Track they've designed. They've designed a machine for producing pressed earth bricks, again open source, and they're hoping to make some money from that. and they're doing like permaculture to do the food, and the idea is to create this sustainable community that everything's using kind of open source principles, but it's actually doing physical stuff, and also incorporating a fab lab for the production of stuff. And I think, I mean, this is probably something, you know, James could talk about a bit, but I think fab labs are a very interesting application of kind of open source ideas to physical production. And it's basically the idea where you have a small place where you have the machines that can be used to produce stuff at any scale of size, and the design of the machines is available on the internet. So basically anyone can hopefully, you know, look up how to make a fab lab, download the information, build a fab lab, and then start producing stuff. And the idea is that, you know, instead of mass production of lots of things the same, you're producing kind of stuff that people want and need and that you can't get elsewhere, type stuff. But that looks like it's got the potential to start to produce stuff that lasts, because everything that's produced now is designed to be binned. Is it something like 90% of all stuff that's sold in the US at the moment is binned within 6 months or something? 90% of everything from the shops, it just gets, you know, and then it gets incinerated or not, and then just landfilled. So I mean, clearly, for open source design of stuff, it needs to be stuff that's reusable, recyclable, maintainable, and lasts a long time, and you know, as well as being useful. There's a lot of potential there, but you know, whether we're going to have time to fundamentally alter the nature of society before we destroy the biosphere.
I think the license should be mentioned here, hearing open source all the time. It's pretty difficult to read.
I fully agree with you.
It's one of the questions.
I'm totally in support of you in terms of, but I mean, it's been useful
pragmatically. The amount of money that corporates threw at this term, you know, it would never spread this fast. Free software would have never spread this fast as open source did, because it was business behind it. So there's use of it. Again, the picking hack,
It happens naturally in a sense, isn't it? Because we're taking it out of the domain of software, so free software is hard by definition, like hard to apply to other artifacts.
Yes,
so
open hardware where it's opening, physical opening makes sense, exactly.
Do you mean that specificity? Is it important?
It's important. I'm
usually very careful to use the terms free software, and I very rarely use the term open source. So if you thought I was using it too much, I'm sorry, that was a mistake. Most people misunderstand free software, though. They think it means just software that they don't have to pay for. They totally don't appreciate that it's the freedom that's important.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you say free software, all I hear is you must share. That is all. You know, you can't. But the way Google and Amazon get away with it, you know, there's a Affero license, which is AGPL, basically, which prevents them. They provide free software as a service. I mean, Google is entirely free software, and BSD. And BSD was funded by whom? By the state. I mean, United States funded through defense research program mainly, and university program. It funded even Stanford. Most of Stanford funding for technology department comes from the state as well.
Are you talking about BSD, the operating system?
Oh yeah, of course. It's a university product that until the university stopped researching it, actually stopped paying for its research in 1995.
Oh, I see, so you're saying they funded it effectively, funding the salary of the person.
Precisely, not a large amount of people, but then because, you know, Sun can, Bill Joy can do his, you know, whatever, you know, write V and package it in as a Sun company, precisely because it's not free software. Because if it was, he couldn't be able. Sun would never happen if he had a free software license.
I wrote that question, and it's because of access-based media.
Yeah.
We meet people coming off the street all the time. I've just been doing a project where people doing all that. Hundreds of people. They don't know what free software is.
Yeah.
Why do they have to listen to a long, entangled ethical argument about the difference between free and open source software before they use it?
No, they don't have to listen.
Well, the thing is that open source is a really nice little, it's a couple of words, and it's got, like I think said, it's got the word open on it.
Yeah.
Source code, you can explain stuff through this. And I think, actually, that open source, although it is problematic in terms of free software, is a very good way of getting people into the idea of free software, simply because it's got two words in it. Right now, obviously, it's descriptive. And obviously, Eric Raymond knew this. I mean, it's a really well designed name.
Marketing term. Yeah.
Right, so And what we do this here, don't we, James? And when we talk about open source, it's an easy way to get across.
Yes.
So I did it very, very quickly. And but if we're not going to use the word open source, what can we do instead? And like you say, Chris, it's like word free has problems.
Well, the answer that's come up, well, the term that's been invented to answer this problem is FLOSS, isn't it? Free,
yeah.
Libre, open source software, which basically kind
it's
of combines the two.
Of course, it's long,
and people don't know what it stands for, but yeah. That's why that was invented, that term.
I mean, if it cost 100 quid, the homeless person couldn't afford it. And if you were offering them free Windows laptops, or free Apple laptops, or free Linux laptops, the important thing would be they are great, they're free. So,
Well, no, actually, that's the fact that it works. But when you say stolen things don't cost anything, do they?
Yes, they do. They cost morally, because people are learning to be thieves. It's very bad for the ethics of everyone who lives around them when everyone's learning to be a thief.
Yeah, okay.
So there's a very big social problem.
I mean, karma costs.
Yes, come back to the comments. Gareth said, they now know that a Windows laptop is a new Windows laptop is worth less to them than a recycled laptop with FLOSS on it. And they know this because they've tried it out and they've been through the process of discovery that workshop's taken through. Now, this is quite important because on Thursday we had the Mayor of Kensington and Chelsea walk into the workshop and they stood there and they talked at him about FLOSS. And I couldn't believe this. I mean, this is kind of like people who've come from zero to being activists in a matter of a few weeks, a few hours a week. Right. And there they are, and they're advocates for FLOSS. So it's standing in front of a
this is what Lisa was talking about before,
with a big chain around his neck being terribly pompous. It's just wonderful,
yeah.
You know. And it's kind of like, well, and then they explained that they got their viruses, and the mayor was really interested.
Yes.
So
it's utility of the term. Yes, I understand. It's more descriptive in that sense.
Yeah.
It's better. But there are three steps there. Not only does open source prevent the you must share. I mean, I would tell homeless person, by open source people, you will never have a house because you will always be considered a non-property owner, while by the free software people who apply to society, you'll be given a place to live because that will be the principle by which we live, which will be must share whatever resources we have. We will remove the scarcity. I mean, London has 100,000 homes, empty. 100,000. And there are only a few thousand homeless people. It's easily solvable, of course. We must be the one who fears being on the street. You know, it's for us to see that this is how you end up unless you support the hierarchical, you know, definition of labor. But then furthermore...
That is rather involved. I must say that the kind of like, just get back to my question, like,
yeah.
How does one say, you know, without using the word open source, the phrase open source, how does one explain things to somebody very quickly? I mean, it's kind of like
I have a simple, as a Dutch pragmatist.
Yeah.
I simply say, well, I always use free software.
Yeah.
If questions come, then I explain.
It's so...
And then they get into the groove, and usually they do that. On the other hand, I've kind of think that two things are free. Free software and free knowledge. All the rest is open. But if they want to use open source, it's no problem. If they start asking, James, why are you using free software? You explain. And things move slowly, but they move.
The confusion comes when it's not software. I think someone mentioned that before.
Yeah.
The minute it's not software anymore, it becomes just freedom, and it becomes too big. But I think, I don't know the answer to Jake's question, but I think one of the ways that you get around it is just by doing, and very quickly, people then become, they then see it. But your question is more about how you explain it in the first place, I guess.
Just one of the very quick sort of pickups from something that you said there, Gareth, which is you said, and as it happens, you know, free software may also be free, as in have no cost associated with it. I have to disagree, actually. There's always a cost associated with engaging with IT. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that there is a cost in terms of time.
Huge,
right? And typically, the argument, if you like, the sales pitch
of the proprietary software vendor is, oh, well, you won't have to learn anything if you just pay this money. You know, to pay this money. Now, that is false. It's always false. Anyone who started using a copy of Windows 7 compared to previous versions will suddenly realize that they've got to learn a whole load of new stuff. However, when you put it to people, look, you're always going to have to invest some combination of money and time in this thing. If you pay with money, you end up poorer. If you pay with time, you end up smarter. Now, you tell me which one's the best, which one is the investment? And the moment that people suddenly see the work of engaging with free software as benefit, not as cost, then suddenly the logic of it becomes clear. And if you look at the counter logic, which is with these proprietary softwares where they say, hey, you don't have to learn anything. Essentially, what they're proposing is, would you like to pay for ignorance?
Jim, I mean, is what you're saying...
Nobody wants to do that.
People have to start to use free software before they get the value of it, before they understand the value of it.
People are using it every day, usually, without being aware of it.
I guess simply my point is that when you get to the total cost of ownership argument, it totally avoids... The question of what's the afterwards that benefits. I'm sure you didn't mean that.
It raises other problems, like you get into the QWERTY keyboard problem, because you've already invested 1,000 hours learning QWERTY, so you don't move to the much more well scientifically proven better keyboard, Dvorak, whatever it is. And the same problem with Windows. You know, my daughter's at school, she's learning computing. The school is full of teachers who've got good intentions. They want to skill her up so that she can get a good job. So they're teaching her computing, and she's learning Microsoft Excel and PowerPoint and Word, because when she comes to walk into an office, they're going to say to her, oh, do you know how to use a computer? And she turns around and says, oh, yeah, I can do macros and GIMP and shell scripting, and, you know, and they say, do you know Microsoft Excel? And she says no, then that's going to put her at a disadvantage. So you might think about the total cost of ownership and the cost of change, but it doesn't always lead you inevitably to the answer, use Linux or Floss software.
But those things are partly a matter of a number of different things, like motivation and desire and your preconceptions, because many, many people are quite happy to get the latest phone every year and work their way around to new interface, which is probably not that much kind of different. If you can build the desirability, then the practicalities are not the barrier. The barrier is something else, I think.
And certainly the kind of learning that I think people do when they engage with free software tends to be a kind of learning which is not learning by rote. It tends to be learning by understanding, which means that what's happening is that people are learning principles of operating interfaces or what have you, which they can then apply to programs specific programs or systems which they've never used.
Yes, but that turns that to an academic. I mean, now I'm forced to spend 90% of my time writing text and reading books, and for me, I want a free software that works. You know, now I'm a user. I want an appliance. You know, I want a fridge. I want to grab, publish, and then it publishes my paper or whatever, as opposed to going back to the code. So I can completely understand the mentality of people for whom it has, you know, immediate utilitarian value. I mean, I always hated mobile phones. Like, you know, it's when I get a new one, it's, you know, it's pain and fun at the same time. But I've been there for 10 years, and I know what you're saying. But at the same time, I mean, I have colleagues that I can make who specifically tell me, we do not want to go through what you're going. We do not want to know. I wanted to click here, and it works. And then I tell them, well, then you use your Windows, and you have 17 clicks in an exact order in order to get what you want. And I type one command line, and it does what I want. They kind of get a little bit disturbed with their logic. But the logic is still there.
But if you like, that this question of, I don't want to know.
Yeah, I just want it to work.
That is,
I want to click
that,
here.
But that is
one button.
That is absolutely the precise buy-in to the sort of hyper-specialism that
we kind of generally feel, you know, with our lower back pain and carpal tunnel syndrome, is not a good thing.
But
it's
how
not fun.
How far do we go? Knit our own carpet.
But they see the pain.
Generate our own electricity. I mean, how can we move away from a hyper-specialised...
Well, at some stage, we might be compelled to do so.
Yeah, without a doubt.
One thing I think, of course, it's an opinion, I don't even know if it's a very important one, but to me, first, we are in the end game, and secondly, the collapse of the system is not a question of if, it's a question of when.
It's not, maybe I can't scream, but that's quite a sort of time-honoured refrain, isn't it? And so, if you carry that backwards in time, and say people have been saying that for the last 50 years, then maybe it's possible to say
been
that
that
people
that
for the next 50 years are going to say,
no,
we're just on the point of collapse. And
actually, they've been saying that for the last 5,000 years.
Well, yes, then. I'd like to have a plan B that involves not expecting everything to fall apart and be born into a new utopia tomorrow, but I think it's important to work on a plan B, which is just try and make it a bit better given what we've got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something you said about your daughter in school, with the going in with going in, when you told you that out, and something that you said about architecture. I've got just a road from where I live, they built like a super high school. It's kind of this enormous building, and one day I looked at it, and on the roof there was yellow, red, blue, and what's the other Microsoft colour? Blocks on top of the roof, on a massive scale.
But like the screen staple locked over.
Yes. I kind of thought, well, what's going on here? And then I found out that the school was sponsored by Microsoft.
No.
And I kind of thought, well, what the hell can I do about it? It's on my doorstep. What can I do about the situation? I was close to handing out distributions of the day, you know, like some sort of Linux process. And I kind of thought, and then the arts officer for the borough, this has been recorded, isn't it? I'm just kind of saying. The arts officer for the borough phoned me up and said, we're putting a lot of new technology in the new schools, and we're looking for artists to be involved in the middle level to kind of see how that technology can be used creatively. And I kind of thought, you don't know what we do. And he kind of phoned me up. So we went along to this meeting thinking, this is going to be really interesting, because we're going to see. Use Linux.
Yeah.
So we thought, great, we can hack into the system, we can change it, we can subvert it, we can add something to it. And we kind of had a 2-hour meeting, which was very nice, and coffee was kind of delicious. And the guy, then he goes, so then it came out that he wanted us to run 4 workshops, 4 teachers, and using specific applications. So GIMP, the various kind of almost equivalent tools that you get in Windows, you know. And we kind of thought, well, that's not the outcome we were hoping for at all. We did the kind of thing that anybody who asks a stupid question on our mailing list gets. We just went home and ignored them. Just kind of not knowing absolutely at what point, where to engage with that process. So rather than come to a conclusion here, if you grab me later and can give me any advice as to where to take that process, I'd be, very grateful, because there is an opportunity there to do some sort of hacking, but we were hacked first.
What are the tools were there besides the GIMP that you wanted you to teach and to use?
Yeah, but we would still be using open tools in a proprietary manner. We would have still been just kind of going for the kind of...
No, I mean, can you just tell me what the other tools were besides GIMP?
Well, you just wanted basically Midjourney, and you wanted
Open Office maybe.
Open Office.
The exact copies, but not look at the process of how they work. So.
Yeah, so we'd still
but
be...
But in the example, show them LaTeX for maths department, and they're most certainly using it in maths department, but then just spread the idea of, that's one way to show a different way.
On a very small level, we've developed here some qualifications that are very low level, so that's a sort of NVQ level 2, which it's an adult education qualification that you can get essentially with 16 hours I think of contact time with a tutor. So essentially in 2 days. And what we did was to develop these very introductory level qualifications
in GIMP, OpenOffice, and web browser, well, essentially networking tools, as well as some other contextual and supporting modules. And we got these validated through the Open College Network, such that the nature of the qualifications are published online, and anyone who's part of the Open College Network can then run these qualifications if they want to. So we tried to do a kind of an open version, if you like, of the vendor qualification, but particularly thinking about that level. So I wonder whether it might add to your credibility in some way to pitch that
existing,
you know, those qualifications could be one of the outcomes
one
that
of the
students get.
One of the benefits of using open tools is the possibility to use tool chains and to hack them about and to subvert them and change, especially as an artist, to reconfigure the metaphorical interfaces and
show them a pipe.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, how you teach, maybe, yes, it would always be controversial about whether it's palatable to go and teach that or not, but what you teach and how you teach it, make all the difference. You have to say, point here, click here, point here, whatever. But if you really teach something that can that can help people feel like it's something they can manipulate, all kinds of different kind of data.
Yeah, that's kind of,
I think,
I was wanting to pull maybe things a bit away, so if anyone wants to carry on.
Well, I was just going to say that what you just described there is the fact that, and what I was trying to get at earlier with architecture, is that these kind of sort of big starting points, actually, they must change the thing. That if you draw these ideas of openness or freeness into different disciplines, they change the discipline. You know, they if you bring it floss into art, then art has to change. You can't think of it in the same way anymore. And the same for architecture. So it doesn't become about, in an architectural sense, the top-down design of buildings for clients who are paying for it in the same relationships. It becomes
the RSA paper, PDF is online, have a look at it. Actually specifies, it's very commercial-oriented. It's completely kind of capitalist hack.
Yeah.
But at least they
try
to make architecture in terms of designs, how objects can interfere with each other,
but
set of principles.
Sure,
Or open Matt Fuller's paper with that guy, that was really
good. The versioning thing.
Versioning of the algorithm.
So if it changed the Windows logo on Earth Dependence, then you're asking if to do something different?
Well, no, they should, that's what you're saying, isn't happening.
Do you think we should pay attention to the contributed questions some more so that we kind of fulfil our remit of openness? Have we got a... Do we want this one? Do we want to read this one out? Or
well, I wanted to say something about...
There's a
Well, I mean, I just was thinking that we were talking about qualifications and possessing a qualification kind of relates to this. So, you know, what is a qualification except a sort of assertion that I possess some information or I've gained some skill or something? And we're talking quite loosely and saying, oh, hacking's a good thing, it's great to hack state, you know, but how great would it be if I hacked the access space qualifications and just said, oh, yeah, I've got all those qualifications? And how great would it be if I posted how to do that on the bulletin board and everybody could do that? And what would the consequences of that be? Well, if I went along and said, look, I've got an OCN from Access Space in GIMP, and they said, I'm sorry, there's 48 million people on the planet who've got that. Actually, suddenly that doesn't have any value anymore. And so...
That's not hacking. That's gaining possession of something in order to falsify a claim. It's not really hacking. Hacking changes the object it intervenes into. I mean, in a way that we talked about earlier. No, a hack would be to take the qualification and implement it somewhere else to still make it part of the state, official, whatever you call it, open college.
The Open College Network have got a kind of validation procedure, which, you know, you can lie about if you want. But, you know, essentially, if you want to get a numbered, you know, certificate that someone can phone them up and validate that it's a real thing, then you have to go through that process. However,
Morris Dancing certificate from Access Space.
Yeah, but the point is actually what you can do with the qualifications: go online, find all the information about how to run the workshop, devise your own qualification framework, and
run your own.
To do something else.
You'd be very welcome to.
Or you could cheat and use DIMP at home, and then you'd be able to do it, you know, without even doing the learning.
Of course. But, I mean, in the end, what a qualification is it's external validation. Right, and there's a big question about whether one actually needs external validation at all.
Whereas exactly on the reverse, you see an onslaught of what I call certification taking place. As being exactly the way to attack the spread of free knowledge. So, for instance, to stay with computing, not so long ago, a lot of computing knowledge was acquired in an informal way because formal education did not exist. And people were recognized simply because what they did worked. You could see the qualification of people was simply the proof that what they were doing was working.
Binning CVs, as Joe used to do, and a degree from some IT university, which was just binning.
And what you got at a certain stage, that this type of knowledge, and especially this type of knowledge acquiring knowledge has become really unwelcome, among other things. So the people having this kind of knowledge were very flexible in their mind, they were doing all kinds of things. So that was replaced by very formal education. I always say that Western certification is a war machine against free knowledge, because only a certain type of knowledge is accepted, and all other types of knowledge are considered invalid.
Academia is a brilliant example. When it matters what certificate you have and not what you know, what can you deliver?
This isn't just an intellectual hegemony like dominating us and oppressing us. I mean, if you break your leg and go to a surgery, then I absolutely want a conventional medical decision. I don't want someone who's self-certified themselves and said, I've got all these crazy ideas. The state won't let me think about fixing bones.
No, you want
the regular doctor.
Don't you want them to fix your leg, actually? Is that what you want?
The regular way, not some wacky way that he's become convinced is great.
You are doing exactly the same thing as what you were doing with my intellectual property in the form of my banking code. Yes, I want to. My bank account number, I want to keep that secret. Of course, that's obvious. It's also obvious that if you break your leg, you want to be held by someone who really knows it. But these are different domains.
Okay, sorry, there's also been sweeping talk about sweeping all of this away and replacing it with a grand new order that doesn't suffer from any of the problems of capitalism.
No, no. But the order has to be...
Whether we're sweep it all away...
In every single domain, exactly like they were saying, the architecture and stuff were directly, it has to be rethought. But here, this question for me, I mean, this question doesn't work, because in a hackerish environment, public never existed. Public is a liberal hack invented in the US primarily, between the two wars, and then voter as well. I mean, these two political subjects do not exist anywhere. I mean, what did voting change here in the last 30 years? You know, what did change in most of European countries? And what's a public? You know, so the question is already phrased in a liberal framework which kills the possible activity of citizen or of member of a community. Therefore, you know, this is how
Quellen needs to work. I don't know, though. I mean, if we simply replace these words, right?
Yes!
Who's
us?
The masses!
People.
But now it's better, it's more open question.
Right?
It's much better.
But other people. Alright? In other words, so what we're doing is we're saying the question is still tremendously valid, though, isn't it? Which is that open frameworks like this have still got the potential for, you know, extremely hierarchical systems.
Yes.
And one of the ways that that's maintained, and, you know, you can see it in academia, and you can see it in the world of free software and hacking, is
one of the ways that these hierarchies are maintained is through coded language. You know, in the case of computing, literally through code. You know, if you can't read it, if you can't understand it, there's some way in which you can't fundamentally get involved. But in academia in particular, there's some amazing mystery language, which, you know, you may be under the impression this is English. I know. You know, some amazing use of language which makes it quite impenetrable to, if you like, the uninitiated. And so, you know, this is, if you like, the counter hack of you know, these hierarchies or gatekeepers, if you like, is coded language, is impenetrable language. And that's
law
the
is
way,
the best example.
Sure, and that's the way that you can have an open call for participation in a local government scheme. And then when you go along to the meeting, a whole load of people in suits are talking in amazing acronyms that you don't understand, and you simply can't make whatever funding bid it is or proposal it is because you don't have the language to engage with that apparently open process.
Can I tell you the kind of this kind of anecdote where I work or sit in Amsterdam? It's the VAR Society, which sits in the VAR building, which is very famous because it contains the Theatrum Anatomicum, the anatomic theatre, where in the 16th, from the early 17th century onwards, the surgical lessons were given, where cadavers were being cut open in the then developing medical science. Now, the interesting thing about this, and you can really see it in the building, it's a fairly large room, circular, where on the ceiling are the armories of the member of the medical guild is somewhere in the 17th, beginning 18th century, somewhere around there, 1650, 1750, something like that. And what you see there is the symbolization, the visualization of the fact that medical science, especially the harsh part of medical science, cutting
surgery,
was done was originally done in the 15th till the 15th century was a side activity of barbers.
Yeah.
Barbers had the cutting instrument to do this kind of thing. Now, as the knowledge progressed, coming first from Italy and also from various other sources, these people started to professionalize. And the professionalization, the augmentation of knowledge, is also a lot of specialization. In itself, it's a good thing. But it went together with a process of social aggrandizement and self-aggrandizement. And it's exactly the moment that the knowledge, the use of code, as James was saying, and the use of very specific... the knowledge was growing, the techniques were sophisticated, there's no doubt about that. In order to do so, they surely had to be stricter, to have more objective way of also testing that knowledge. They had also a whole system of exams and so on, which barbers had somewhat less. Also, barbers were also organized in guilds, which are self-regulating and self-examining bodies. And these people simply shot up in the social ranks, from barbers, which was not a very well considered occupation, to surgeons. Well, you can imagine what the chief surgeon in a hospital these days is looking at in terms of. And yet, you cannot say that this came only from the knowledge. The knowledge surely became greater, but the social aggrandizement became even greater. And my proof that it need not to be the case is somewhat tainted because it comes from the Soviet Union and the Ost Bloc in general, where the degree of medical knowledge was surely not bad. It was surely not, maybe it lagged a bit behind in purely technological terms to the West. But it was very specialized, very high quality knowledge. Yet the social standing of medical people was never as high as it was here, and their remuneration also. I mean, they earn something like three or four times as much as a tram driver.
Not even that. Kieslowski's that. Ten Commandments movie is the best one, the one when they live in a skyscraper with the doctor living together with the teacher, and they're all in the same flat. That's a true story. I mean,
so, I was just saying that you can also not dissociate the social aspects and the social aggrandizement and self from the knowledge itself. And I think it's a bit. I mean, people, we were talking about ethics. If you have ethics, you are not going to fuck around with knowledge. The knowledge must be good. And you damn well know what is good knowledge and what is fake. So
this hacking, in a wider sense, succeeding, would depend on everybody who had the skills of hacking being ethical.
Yes.
When you're saying succeeding and failing, just what are you meaning there?
Well, like we're saying, it's a good thing to spread the knowledge of how to hack.
Well, spreading the knowledge is okay, yes, but hacking may not succeed.
Yeah,
if it's done for bad ends,
and
I hope it doesn't.
No, but a lot of hackers are really successful millionaires. I mean, they're really, they have a great business acumen, and you know, and they will share what benefits them to get their businesses going. They won't share anything that endangers their business. And you know, Google is a great example. There's no doubt that the two guys who started are brilliant hackers' minds. They think exactly like hackers. And you know, what are they? They're billionaires they're the ones who use the commons. They use our websites. You know, they use our money because the U.S. funded Stanford, you know, research, not their salaries. They use all of that, and they use just a little bit of seeds, which was $100,000 and was important first seed. And then they get another $1 or $2 million, which is all joke money. And what do we end up? We end up, they suck all the best brains in Google. They don't return anything. Absolutely nothing comes. It's a black box. And the GPL kicks in only when you redistribute your software. So if you change it internally in your company and you just serve websites, you're not breaking the GPL by not returning any of it. So basically, they don't even have to support open source software. They can support free software, quite, you know, strict licenses, and they still don't return anything back to the commons. Yet, what do they use? They use our websites and our desire to search. I mean, Google is a great example of in many states, many ways, brilliant tool makers and truly evil anti-community, anti-socialist, anti-communist, capitalist bastards. I mean, they're the worst investors. No, they're the worst investors at the same time. They're some of the best hackers, and they're a true evil company, really, in many ways.
But,
I love their tools.
But people will find your speech here on Google. they will be facilitating your criticism of them.
I love their tools. I just think that they should be taken apart and broken by government. They should be internationalized, and they should be forced by sheer force by, you know, monopoly and violence. I mean, military occupation of Google campus, that would be mine. If we're talking about the public side, to make sure that, and people are talking about deep search conference, I recommend this. It's basically you can separate indexing, the application of sorting algorithms, and the searching mechanisms. There are two more in layers in between. You can separate them. So, for example, all the Greek people in UK, which is a huge network in Germany, in France, in within universities funded by the state, has access to all the documents that Google indexes. Because what Google indexes is not the common; it's ours. French state was the first one that said, you know, let's not give Google to do what they want with the territory of France, because this is for me geopolitics. You know. The documents that are on French territory belong to the French state. The French state has no power anymore. You know, they don't live in the age of sovereign state. They can intervene. Yet they tried to intervene and failed. So I think we should intervene in Google. We should definitely take over the Google. It should not be owned by private people. There's no doubt. It's ours.
But before the tanks start rolling in, we can also apply the law of Massachusetts.
Yes.
A corporation is dissolved after 20 years. And we start all over again.
Sorry, I missed that.
The old law of Massachusetts states that a private company, a private business, had to be dissolved every 20 years.
Ah. And that applies to Google, does it?
Well.
No way.
I mean, what was the corporation? It was a public good mechanism. It was literally defined as a mechanism to deliver large-scale public good works, which no single company, private company at the time, could do. That's how it was defined at the beginning. And look at what he had. So it's a very good hack by capitalists to use corporation as a do-good entity to become a private enterprise entity. But we don't do the opposite. So that's my main beef, is we don't hack them. We never use their tools to do something with them. And GPL is a good example of doing that, using the law, which was primarily designed to oppressed. I mean, here it was 11th century. It was, you know, the king's barons were the first who used the law to impose Magna Carta, to tell the king, no, it's our land, it's not your land. So I think in that sense, GPL is a great hack, because it uses something that was not meant to be for us, the law.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of patent was once, you know, the king gave it to allow someone to have a monopoly.
Yeah.
But in fact, I mean, just I've kind of got a personal interest in this, because as it happens, my father was a patent agent. So I've been kind of brought up with a whole...
You've been brainwashed.
No, absolutely. I've thought quite a lot about issues of intellectual property.
Mm.
And the original reason for the introduction of patent law was to stop people from keeping secrets. In other words, it was to say, look, you have a secret process here, which is, you can make this mysterious gunpowder or you know, principally weapons, but all sorts of valuable things. Now, essentially what was happening was that manufacture was done behind closed doors in secret societies, and when people died, human knowledge was lost. And so the idea of the patent originally was to ensure that private individuals would in some way be rewarded for declaring what it is that they do. Now, this is doubly ironic, because the purpose of patent law, the whole purpose of the framework of it, is to enhance innovation. But what we're seeing now, particularly in the IT arena, is that patent law is being used to hold back innovation.
They're realizing.
So,
I think it's a national science for some one of those large committees that US government does. They actually said in the latest report last year,
absolutely,
it is actually preventing US from being generating new ideas, and it's other countries who don't care about patents or copyright or anything,
correct,
that are generating new ideas in science.
And
we are falling behind.
And it may well be that actually the correct answer is that if you are granted, you know, that software patent law will need to be reformed in such a way that you are granted a patent and it's an absolute monopoly for 6 months.
Yeah.
Stay lucky.
Yeah,
you know. And one of the propositions as well of patent law is that you must exploit the patent. In other words, you must make the product or service which you are patenting available to the public, and if you don't, then it's invalid.
Yeah.
But the thing is that particularly there are differences between US and European patent law which are absolutely crucial, and they seem like they're minor. And a particular difference is that in European patent law you must have a working prototype, whereas in US patent law there is no requirement for a working prototype. And so, for example, there are hundreds of patents of flying cars.
Yeah.
Flying cars would be great. Someone who went down to the US patent office and said, that's a good idea, we'll be collecting your money. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why we don't have flying cars.
Well, it's not new.
Yeah.
These patent problems aren't
yeah.
new to IT. I mean,
sure.
like the development of the steam industry was held up by
yes,
Watts.
That's a great example.
Patents
yeah, yeah.
That, it was
yeah.
only when he died and the patents expired
yeah.
that high-pressure steam engines
yeah.
got going. Because while he had the patents, he was making 50 engines a year.
Yeah.
And he was happy. He was making lots of money.
Yeah.
And what was the problem? And it was when he died, and then of course steam took off, and soon there were thousands of engines made every day.
Yeah.
And the other one is flying, of course. The Wright brothers had spent the last 20, 30 years of their life in a series of bitter patent fights to stop other American aircraft manufacturers developing planes. Europe didn't have the problem, so the aircraft industry got going in Europe. And it was
yeah.
only when the Wrights, again, I think, either died or finally lost in court and stopped fighting the patents.
So
I think America may well shoot itself in the foot by having all these ridiculous.
I think they're realizing
clicks
yeah.
and the idea of you know.
Also, they're realizing they're using too much money on lawyers. They're saying small software companies simply cannot play in this field. And when they do play, the amount of budget they use on lawyers fighting each other is too large. Therefore, they don't innovate. They don't actually produce the product they should be producing.
Yeah.
They just fight legally.
The barrier to entry
but
gets
in,
so high that nothing.
You know where this patent law thing is amazing? In biotech, it's the most amazing that I read, because there. They're realizing that the only mechanism they can use to actually patent seeds of Indian farmers and sell it back to them is through a mechanism legal fiction. because you have to basically say, you know, legally fictitious mechanisms, said we know this is untrue, however, for the purpose of court reaching the decision, like the king is present in every courtroom, that's a legal fiction. We will consider it to be true temporarily so that it works. One of the legal fictions that's crucial for biotech is that a living organism can be described in perfect terms so that it can be repeated or recreated. In the definition actually in UK patent law is that the steps must be repeatable and the same result must be obtained by a specialist who is, and there's some definition of specialist, that's who is, or whatever, a geneticist or something. But they know, and they use legal fiction, that it's impossible to do this for living organisms, because living organisms change. That's the whole point. You can't have the same seed 3 years down the line. So, you know, they're being very, very clever about using, that's another term for me, you know, why don't, you know, people like ourselves have the, how should I say, the ambition to use, for example, legal fiction. It's a phenomenal term. You can go in a courtroom and argue, this is not true, but nevertheless, it will reach these political goals, economic goals. You know, we never do that. I've never seen anyone on the left saying, let's imagine things, go to courtroom, have lawyers and fight it.
So,
have you got more money?
There are lawyers who do it pro bono.
And isn't it interesting that on the one hand, you know, here we're saying, well, perhaps patent law might become more benign if its time scale is hugely compressed, particularly in the ICT field. That might actually promote disclosure and promote innovation and promote sharing. And yet, if you look at the major media companies that are owners of intellectual property, what they're arguing for is precisely the opposite. That in the year 2500, that the music industry will all be reselling the Beatles over and over and over again. You know,
you want the copyright, that's more.
Yeah, that copyright should last longer and longer, you know, sort of 170 years after the deaths of the artists and all their art.
Much better. Eternity minus one day.
Or how about eternity plus one day?
Well, the last one was a serious Venturi.
It was a good to fly.
You also signed the contract now that says includes new life forms. If you sign a record contract, you have to include the possibility that aliens may.
No, but I signed all possible universes, including the newly discovered ones. That was my case. No, I signed it. That was like 5 years ago. I signed it, and I couldn't believe. Actually, you know, told them, can I challenge this? And they said, well, if you do, there's no job offer. So you're free to challenge it, but then, you know, that's it. That's the end of the job offer.
That's
the extent, isn't it? So, and then I signed it and released it all as free software. And they said, well, you're risking your job, but we don't think we can monetize it. We don't valorize. So most likely, no one will care about you or whatever. Free software stuff, too, you know, no one's going to make money on it as well. But you're risking your job when you do it. For the all eternity and all universes.
Yes, all my
fault. Are there other questions? Because I'm aware here that time is pressing.
Well, one thing that occurred to me, we've been using the terms GPL, BSD, and things like that. And I mean, is everyone clear about the differences in the nature of these software licenses and what they mean? Or would it help anyone to try and just briefly go through that?
You mentioned GPL, but what was the other one that you
BSD?
mentioned?
BSD.
But isn't that just the name of the operating system?
It's often used as shorthand for a category of license that is more liberal than the GPL. So like the X11 license, the Apache license, and others, and the difference between those licenses and the GPL is the GPL requires that when you distribute the code or the compiled code, you have to distribute the source and you have to give the people you're passing it onto the same freedoms that you have. So it requires, basically it's using copyright law to require sharing of freedoms.
In perpetuity.
Yeah, it mandates sharing.
That's right. Whoever you sell it to or give it to, you always have to pass on the same freedoms to other people. With BSD X11 licenses, they don't have that restriction. So some people regard them as being more free. But what it means is that you can take that code, you can incorporate it into proprietary software, you can, and which you can then sell, and you are not obliged to redistribute source code. So, for example, you know, Apple is often cited as an Apple. They use a lot of BSD code, incorporate it into their proprietary operating system, and then sell it. And a fair bit of it they do make available, Open Darwin and all of that. But, you know, maybe there's some better examples where they don't make anything available. But basically, there isn't the...
Well, TCP stack parts of TCP stack in Windows are still BSD code.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good example. So basically, with those licenses, they're, some people describe them as more free because they don't have that kind of enforced sharing thing. But, you know, I personally think the GPL's a lot better because it does mean that you're, you know, because I think that the sharing thing is the kind of the most important thing, and that's the most, you know, that's the most interesting hack on copyright law. I mean, basically I see the GPL as being a kind of a way of using copyright law to kind of fundamentally undermine the copyright.
Oh, yes, I agree. GPL
and that's
great.
Yeah.
Very good. It gets complicated towards the end, the bits of sort of distribution, because they go on about libraries as well.
Sure, and then it's all even more complicated by, as has been mentioned, applications that you're using, like, you know, Google or something when it's running using free software, and they're not actually distributing the application; they're just distributing the results of the application.
We're getting very close to the end now, I guess. I just wonder whether any of the people who came to the audience have any specific questions to ask any of the people who came to the panel. Given that there are quite a lot of different backgrounds.
Well, I mean, I was hoping that identity would come up as a sort of topic, because I think that relates to a lot of what we talk about, hacking the state and having information and being in control of bits of it.
Meaning personal identity?
Yeah, it's also very topical area. Well, I got a summary healthcare record notification through the post the other day, and the government sort of gradually trying to collect our data to give it an idea of our identity. And so, and the local councillors, for example, kind of getting towards having a citizen ID database to serve us better.
This, I think, is an ideal example of the sort of interface between, you know, hacking the state and the state hacking us, if you like. And I think it's very interesting to reflect that on the one hand, people can be very concerned about, you know, the state's carrying data on, for example, our legal, tax, medical status. But yet, people are voluntarily yielding up data not only about their legal, tax, and medical status, but also their friends, opinions, sexual preferences,
trips, everything, where you are,
what have you, onto social networking sites. So people are voluntarily yielding up far more intrusive data to foreign, private, for-profit companies.
Do you not think, James, perhaps part of that is because they're doing it in an analog mindset,
quite
thinking it's stuck on a page. They don't for a moment consider that it's fluid. They don't for a moment consider it has any other location than on that page. So I agree with you. I think the identity thing is really interesting. And I've been thinking about Marshall McLuhan's idea of the media being extensions ourselves, and ourselves extending into networks through its information about us, and how the respect for those bits of us has to change so that they are respected and the control. People are obliged to ask us what they want to do with these bits of us, rather than assumptions being made. And it's, about, you know, it's a common sense thing to say, but actually I think we're drifting very much into it being intact, because it's based on an analog idea of what secure means.
I have the opposite. I have completely opposite view here. The 99% of hackers completely disagree with, and CCC conference in Berlin, they always have this Stasi 2.0, you know, that they see all of this, but I would open everything up by default, and I would want in return, basically I call it, I would give away my liberal identity of being property owner, being information, do whatever you want with everything other than a few minor things like maybe health record, maybe my banking, some details I would not give away. I would definitely want people to share how much you pay mortgage, how much you pay bills, you know, how much you pay for certain goods, and I would change, I would choose which goods. So radical openness, yes, withdraw certain things. I would not want my physical movement to be known to everyone. So very few things in order to ask the same thing for the city of London and the state.
Well, no,
we have to do this first, because they say to us, come on, citizens, you are liberal citizens, you have your privacy, you have your identity, we want ours as well. But based on their identities, they're suppressing, you know, they're making my life a mess. I can't work 3 days a week, you know, enjoy the life, because we grant them the privacy. I think we need to reject the notion of privacy, go totally open, hide a few things, yes, few things which are important. And then our City of London, fine, open records, open accounting, you know, open government truly, an open process with translators. Because you're right, what's the open process for if you don't have translators that will make language actually applicable to general, you know, average citizens?
Well, the law of unintended consequences, I mean, if you said to anyone in the 70s, like, well, imagine a world where you can post letters to all your mates and it doesn't cost anything. Everyone in the world can send emails to each other free of charge. Wouldn't that be a magical utopia where we all just get loads of nice messages? And what have we got? 99% spam in our inbox.
Yeah.
So, that's what a world of free messaging means.
I do wonder whether actually spam is a very kind of positive thing. Because it kind of is a signal. It's a huge amount of chaff, if you like, which is very easy for an individual email user to pick out the actual signal. Very, very difficult for anyone who isn't the intended recipient to pick out the signal from the message.
Spam Assassin does a good job.
Yeah.
Very
good
time.
Can I just pick up I just pursue you slightly on this, your opposite view to me, because my slightly sort of worrying perspective is the state digital archaeologists of the future who drive through all the servers of messages and things and are acting in an entirely illiberal way to pursue me. Because I think that's more likely to happen than it all to be freedom. While I don't disagree with you in principle, I suspect in practice, and I'm always astonished how willing people are to believe the state will be good and won't be horrible to them. And I think we're naively leaving lots and lots of information about
strategically, not everything. We need to be very careful what bits, but default is openness, and closure is strategic, I agree with you. You would have to close
in end. And you can't know what voters will have a value in the future, something quite innocuous now.
Well, I was going to say, I think patterns, you see. You see patterns and movements and shapes and things that we're meeting meetings later.
It exists now, but they might not have any value now, but they might in the future.
But that said, one could say that, you know, those archaeology, you know, those data archaeologists of the future, you know, we have this idea that somehow archaeology is about scarcity of information. And it may be that, you know, in 500 years' time, when they're looking back at this particular period, the problem won't be scarcity of information. The problem will be excess of information, a kind of fire hose of information, to the point where, for example, any famous and well-known figure, you'll be able to find out what they ate for every single meal and how much they paid for it and who they were with and who what they talked about.
No.
And the question will suddenly become, why is any of this important? You know, in other words, the whole process will be about saying, well, I'm deciding that this, to interpret this particular thing, is important. You know, this particular political decision was made.
Well, we all found out what was important when people got the ability to look at things on the internet, and it suddenly emerged that a lot more people wanted to look at naked pictures of other people than anybody suspected from the top shelf of W.H. Smith. And, you know, that's now become a truth that that's what people want to look at. And you know, what Britney Spears had for lunch and all the rest of it. That's people.
Just a minor Google hack, over the last few months, I've been tracking the relative popularity of Pamela Anderson and Nelson Mandela. Okay? And I have to tell you that for the last 5 years, Pamela Anderson has been definitively more popular as a search term than Nelson Mandela.
until the turn of this year. In December 2009, Nelson Mandela overtook Pamela Anderson. Now, I don't know whether it's about age, you know, but there you go. You know, suddenly, now, Nelson is you know, more searched for than Pam. You know?
Nothing to do with speech, by the way. Shall we
end on that note? I think this is a nice note. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks very much to everybody for coming.
Thanks for
coming. And I guess some people will get more trains quite soon, some won't.
Yeah.
But there's a pub across the road which does serve coffee as well, and there's a beer garden, and it's sunny. So, anybody fancy it?
Yeah.
Can we go ahead?